Furthermore, examination of the location of the shadows and highlights in the photograph verifies that the object and the scene were apparently taken under the same conditions of illumination. After conducting all tests on the photo, Davis concluded, "Nothing was found in the examination of the print which could cause me to believe that the object in the photo is anything other than a large object photographed a distance from the camera." Davis' findings encouraged Stevens, but Elders, still cynical, punched holes in his enthusiasm. The results gave them a green light on the photographs for now, he admitted, but much more sophisticated analysis would have to be performed. And Elders reminded Stevens that a metallurgist at the University of Arizona had already examined one of Mir's metal specimens and labeled it pot metal, a low-grade casting alloy used to make such things as tin soldiers. These were the initial steps in the analysis, recalled Welch. Compared to what ultimately occurred, they were very, very, very basic. Welch suggested that before they ran more tests on any of the evidence, they needed additional information from Switzerland. No one yet had stood on the sites with the Mir photos in hand, determined where Mir had stood, and then measured distances to objects in the pictures. Such comparisons might give them clues as to how Mir could have staged the scenes. Welch, too, wanted to roam about the farm with both eyes open. As the son of an ex-FBI agent, he knew he might see things the others had missed. As a boy, Tom Welch remembered watching his father circle tough FBI cases, some of them involving attempted communist infiltration of unions in Chicago and Tucson. His father had probed and thought, gathered his information, and assessed it. Welch's fascination with his father's work influenced his own curiosity about how things are, as opposed to how they seem to be. "My interests have always run along the lines of investigation," said Welch, "of digging behind mysteries. Even when I was young, I remember distinctly a number of cases of my dad's where things so elaborately obvious turned out to be so different in reality. And how that was dug up just fascinated me." 10 years younger than Lee Elders, Welch was 6 feet tall and thin, with a narrow brown beard and mustache outlining his jaw and upper lip. A Roman Catholic, Welch had been educated by priests of the Jesuit order, which perhaps explained his demeanor. Whereas Elders visibly simmered, quick to exude charm or release a formidable temper, the soft-spoken and articulate Welch remained detached, composed, and analytical. The two men greatly complemented one another. Welch was the only one in the group who had yet to visit the Mir farm, to speak with Mir and the witnesses, to observe at least the countryside where Mir had taken his photographs and shot his movie footage. Welch knew Lee Elders well, and through him had spent time with Wendell Stevens. He respected their opinions, but until he experienced for himself the feel of the place, the demeanor of the people, and had the opportunity to test some of his own hypotheses, he reserved judgment on the case. The Honeywell Symposium in Phoenix has been an international conference attended by representatives of government agencies, the banking industry, and the military of various countries, and Honeywell had presented Tom Welch as an expert in electronics communications protection. Already, another international client had called from outside London, requesting the services of Intercept. Elders and Welch continued to sweep corporate offices and search for leaks in corporate telecommunications systems. But their curiosity over Mir and his story was growing, and as it did, Intercept slowly received less and less attention. Welch ceased making his frequent speeches at service club luncheons, and the firm no longer solicited business through private contacts. "We were still doing a lot of work for Intercept," said Elders. "Steve was working on Mir. But we reached a point where we finally had to just put Intercept on the shelf because we didn't have time for it." At the end of July, a large financial institution, 80 miles outside London, contacted Intercept through the Honeywell Corporation. Fearing that a competitor had tapped into their telephone system, the directors of the company wanted an immediate sweep of the entire office building. Elders and Welch blocked out a full 2 weeks on their slowly shrinking Intercept schedule and told Stevens to meet them in Switzerland after they had concluded their work in London. Now warm and dry in the hills southeast of Zurich, they finally could walk and measure the sites where Mir had taken his photographs. Elders and Welch flew to London and, after several long days of work, solved their client's problem. Then, they boarded the train for Zurich where Stevens was to pick them up in a rental car and drive them to the farm. With better than a week to investigate Mir, the people, and the sites, and to pursue the theories they had formulated back in Phoenix, Welch figured they would leave Switzerland with answers. But by now, Elders had seen and heard much with his own eyes and ears, and he was beginning to sense the difficulty of Mir having fabricated the entire story and all of the evidence. No education, no accomplices, no resources. It was becoming easier to believe that perhaps part of Mia's story was true. Still, some things seemed not to fit, others simply were too outlandish to believe, and nothing definitive had yet been done with the photographs. It even appeared that the metal sample was anything but extraordinary. Though Elders admitted confusion, Mia's evidence had to pass several more tests before he would concede there might be some degree of truth in what the man claimed. As planned, Stevens met them at the train station in Zurich and drove through Winterthur to the small village of Dussenen, over the hills and about 15 minutes by car east of the farm. They checked in at the Gasthaus Brückenwage, where the Elders had stayed the previous spring, a three-story guesthouse with green shutters bordering many windows, each still now bursting with bright red geraniums. Though they had had little sleep on the night train to Zurich, it was a sunny morning in Switzerland, and Elders and Welch wanted to get to the farm as soon as possible. After they had unloaded their car and carried their things up to the room, the three of them drove over the hills, through the farms and pear orchards, to Schmidruti. Welch sat in the back seat, observing the countryside and thinking about the information he wanted to collect at the sites, from the configuration of the forests surrounding the landing track sites to the distances between objects in the photos. But he kept reminding himself not to overlook the less obvious. "I wanted to get a feeling as much as I wanted to get facts," he said. "I wanted to get an insight into the people there as much as I wanted to get measurements and other things that we had scheduled out." As when Stevens had arrived at the farm late the previous fall, and again when the Elders had been there in early spring, young people from all over Europe had come on motorcycles and by foot to Hinterschmidruti, and pitched their tents in various places around the farm, some in the large grassy field below the duck pond. As it was midsummer, the weather had turned mild and warm, and the number of those camped there had greatly increased. Others, many of them older, had driven there, and of these many slept in the tiny, simple rooms at the Friof along the cobblestone row in Schmidruti. Verena Führer, the Friof's cherub-faced proprietress, said that in summer the people who came to see Mia accounted for 25% of her business. "A few French," she explained. "But most are German, some are Austrian, Americans, a lot of Swedes, some Dutch." Mia was waiting for them in front of the farmhouse when they arrived. He now had a full beard, reddish in spots and beginning to curl. As they shook hands, Welch looked into his eyes as Elders had done before, but he saw and felt nothing familiar, no magnetism, and no déjà vu. Welch saw only an earthly man wishing for a simpler life. "He looked to be in the middle of something not under his control," said Welch, "something he was learning from." Welch noted immediately that Mir was not an eager man. Although he acted cordially toward Welch, he seemed at the same time almost indifferent to his presence. Welch soon discovered this indifference pervaded the farm. "I expected either to have a story laid on me, in other words, people making an effort to explain things out of enthusiasm or some ulterior motive, or the reverse, people trying to hide something. Instead, it was as though we weren't even there. They would answer any questions that we had, and they related to us one to one, but they had no reaction one way or the other to what we were doing." Though Welch had many questions for Mir, he had already decided that little of substance could be learned from the man himself. The story lay in the eyes of the witnesses and the terrain of the contact sites. Mir served only as a focus for the story, not someone to question, but someone to question others about. Welch was more interested in walking the sites and talking to the Swiss Weather Bureau than in chatting with Mia. The procedure they had devised for assessing the contact sites was to take each 3x5 print in the series photographed at the site, locate the exact point from which the photographs had to be taken, and begin measuring. Measure distances, measure heights, measure the width of trees, even the height of blades of grass, said Welch. Looking for that kind of detail is the way we walked onto each site. Beginning that afternoon and continuing for the next several days, they visited 4 of the alleged contact sites, accompanied by Mia. Just driving to the sites, Welch perceived problems with the theories they had formulated back in Phoenix. Some of the sites were up steep grades, passable in summer, but a strain for the car to climb. Yet Mia had taken many of his photos on these sites in late winter or very early spring, when snow covered the paths or melted and turned them to mud. Welch remembered, that's where the theories started disappearing. They had been at the first site only briefly when Welch noticed another similar problem, one of many experiences he soon labeled gross consistencies. A gross consistency was usually a simple observation that in some small way corroborated Mia's story. Singly, each added little weight, collectively, they made the curious story seem even more mysterious. What Welch noted at the first site and everyone thereafter was that from the time they got out of the car, looked over the site, and began taking measurements, no more than 20 minutes would pass before someone came up and asked them who they were, or what they were doing, or why they were there. Or, they would simply stand and watch. Once, Welch walked onto a site, expecting it to be secluded, only to find a farmhouse not more than 100 yards from where Mia had taken his photographs. Driving to the site near that farmhouse along a side road, Elders, Welch, and Stevens had encountered another car traveling in the opposite direction. Moments later, when Mia directed Stevens to pull off onto a narrow path leading to the site, the other car had turned around, followed them, and parked. Then, the occupants had watched them walk around the area measuring trees and distances for most of the time they were on the site. Essentially, we thought we were dealing with remote sites, Welch said later, where you could fairly well do anything you wanted unseen and uninterrupted for a lengthy period of time. And that you could get to that site without being observed. This was another factor just blown out the window. Welch obtained weather reports, thinking he could use them to confirm or invalidate the background of the pictures taken at each site. For example, he offered, August 8, 1975. Was that actually a cloudy day? Wouldn't it be funny, he said, to learn that the shot here with the deep ruffled clouds in the background, storm clouds, could not have been shot in 1975 in August. Although he found no inconsistencies, Welch discovered that often the weather reports themselves could be misleading. The sites lay mostly in the foothills where the weather could change in minutes. And having experienced these radical changes at the sites, Welch could then listen to the nearest weather source reporting mild temperatures and consistent skies during that same period. The weather impressed me to no end, said Welch. Particularly Haysenbol. You can stand there for an hour, and in some cases, nothing will happen, it'll be a beautiful sunny day. At other times, you'll go from beautiful sunny to deep clouds and a little mist and rain and fog to what seems like it's definitely going to snow and get cool and then hefty breezes pop up all of a sudden. It was like standing in one place and going to 3 or 4 different climates and not moving an inch. And that presented another angle we hadn't thought about, the further difficulty of faking anything on those sites because of the weather. And you can't just visit those sites for 5 minutes to learn this, you have to spend some time at them. One thing Welch had starred in his notes was to view the drop behind the tree in the Haysenbol photos. He had formulated various theories on how Mia could have rigged these photos of a beam ship that appears to be almost in the branches of the tall leafless tree. Late on a sunny afternoon, they climbed the steep, rutted path to the site, where Welch found a grassy bluff facing into the setting sun and in the distance a succession of jagged peaks as far as he could see. When he walked to the tree at the edge of the bluff and saw the land drop sharply away, roll down and down across a wide valley, His theories simply dissipated in the wind. The tree was 52 yards from where Mia had taken the picture. By measuring the trunk of the tree as it stood, and as it appeared in the photo, basic triangulation gave him the size of the beam ship. "That's often a simple mistake people make when they're hoaxing," explained Welch. "The ship they film just couldn't be the size they say it is when compared to the other known objects in the photograph. According to their measurements, the beam ship at the edge of the tree over Hasenbol had to be approximately 21 feet in diameter, as Mia had always said. We had developed some possible theories by that time that we wanted to apply to the circumstances," said Welch, taking a real strong look at the sites and doing some measuring. "But you go to one of those sites, and you compare the photographs right there, and you see the perspective for yourself. Just eyeballing it, you know you're not dealing with something that is easily rigged by amateurs because of the nature of the terrain, the topography, the wind, and even the laws and regulations of Switzerland. The country is so small, and jets run down those valleys sometimes no higher than 200-300 feet, and you'll see them doing barrel rolls, loops, and dogfights at that height. So there were a lot of little technical things that kind of blew out the perception of this being an easily explained circumstance. Now, here's the conditions under which these photographs were taken at Hasenbol. You have severe cold, you have high winds, you have a good amount of snow on the ground. We were there in summer, and you could barely get up the hill because it was too muddy and slippery. What we're talking about here is passing that farmer's house on a very wintry late afternoon. Anybody out in that kind of weather is a little unusual, and the people there are nosy as hell. Now, here comes a man on a moped, all right, and he's going to go up through this farmer's land, up this bluff, in this weather. And it's not snow plowed up there. He's going to go up there in the wind and the weather, and he's going to deal with all the technical factors in the midst of all that. Always present, yet far more subtle than the difficult terrain or the curiosity of stranger, one thing that would have made the hoaxing of the photographs virtually impossible occurred to Welch only slowly as he stood at sight after sight. Finally, he focused on what he had been feeling in the air: moisture, heavy, constantly changing, and invisible, except to a camera lens. For all its beauty, perhaps largely responsible for that beauty, Switzerland is a damp country. A large object posing independently could be photographed several times in a matter of seconds, and the atmosphere would remain constant throughout the series. A model of any size would require setting up and repositioning, a procedure that could consume an hour or more. In that time, the background might change. "You have weather so inconsistent," remembered Welch, "that in 15 minutes you can go from literally zip, clear sharp air to very thick air, actual mist. That alone would drive a technician crazy trying to fake photos. It would cause too much bluing." "Also," said Welch, "you need time. Because if it's a model, you've got to throw it 5 times before you get your shot, or hang it and run it and play with it a bit. This would drive you crazy with the wind, the moisture, there are probably a dozen factors. If you're going to fake this, you need time." The one thing you can see that Mia did not have a lot of at any of these sites, whether he's faking them or taking them, is time. By the mid-1950s, a coterie of men claimed not only to have seen remarkable spacecraft, but to have flown in them and to have talked at length with the occupants. They were known as contactees, and their stories so captured the public imagination that they completely thwarted Air Force efforts to downplay flying saucers. They also undermined the work of private UFO organizations searching seriously for answers. The contactees, most notably George Adamski, Truman Bethlehem, Orfeo Amschlucci, Daniel Fry, and Howard Menger, each claimed to have been contacted by Space Brothers, who gave him a mission to save the world from greed, corruption, and the atomic bomb. The Space Brothers took them aboard a Venusian, Saturnian, Jupiterian, or Martian spaceship, where they saw beautiful women and received further instruction from Orthon, Aura, Alan, or Neptune, and heard of idyllic conditions on their home planets, a situation to which the people of Earth could aspire. National interest in the contactees was so great that over 150 flying saucer clubs sprang up dedicated just to them. In 1954, contactee George Van Tassel sponsored the first giant rock convention in Yucca Valley, California, a carnival affair with contactees giving lectures on their experiences and selling souvenirs from booths. Over 5,000 people came. In the fall of 1956, the 34-year-old Menger, a pipe-smoking sign painter with black wavy hair and a long thin neck, appeared with his story on The Tonight Show with Steve Allen. Journalist Jules B. Street Germain described the scene in the November 1957 Argosy, the audience's original reaction, which ranged from snickering to outright laughter when it learned that Menger claimed to have ridden on a flying saucer, changed to a mood of perplexed wonderment and keen interest shortly after he started speaking. Amusement soon became interested silence. Menger told the audience that earlier that year, the space beings had taught him to communicate through telepathy and had flown him to Venus where he saw beautiful domed buildings. "I rode through space in a Venusian scout ship," he said. "It is a difficult feeling to describe, a feeling of no motion, of suspension in space. I was shown, through some means of teleprojection, a view of life in a city on Venus. It was not too different from ours. More orderly, quiet, much more beautiful." He also had traveled to the moon, where he could breathe the air with little difficulty. "Most of the people who have contacted me," he said, "have been from the planet Venus, although I have seen others from Mars and Saturn. Some live on our Earth among us." After Menger's radio and television appearances, so many thousands of people came to his home in Highgate, New Jersey, that at one point, the police had to be called in to unravel a traffic jam in front of the house. Street Germain, visiting in late fall 1956, found 300 people there on a single afternoon. The public demanded little proof, seemingly content with a contactee's sincerity. As evidence of his contacts, the father of contacteeism, Adamski, showed skeptics 18 photographs, some of spots and shadows, and some of a murky, bell-shaped object with what appeared to be wheels on the bottom. He also had one Venusian footprint cast in plaster of Paris and containing a coded message. Other contactees had less to show. Bethram offered a note written in French. A contactee named Buck Nelson sold $5 packets of hair from a Venusian St. Bernard he said weighed 385 pounds. Angelucci and Fry had only their word. Like Adamski, Menger had photographs, five of them, one of a black mummy shape standing before a glaring rounded object, a Venusian in front of his scout ship, said Menger. Menger also cut a commercial record called The Song from Saturn, actual music that came from another planet. He once wrote to one of the UFO organizations, "We are tired of mysteries, hearsay, and ugly rumors circulating about saucer researchers and contactees. Incidentally," he added, "we have a scientist who is working on the qualitative analysis of the vegetables brought back from the moon." See, in January 1957, Major Donald Kehoe, a graduate of Annapolis, retired Marine Corps pilot, and former aide to Charles Lindbergh, became head of a privately organized group called the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena. Formed only several months earlier, NICAP eventually boasted a membership of 12,000, including many politicians, scientists, and high-ranking military officers. Kehoe established NICAP headquarters in Washington, D.C., and appointed prominent people to its board of governors, one of whom was Vice Admiral Roscoe Hinko Etter, a Naval Academy classmate of Kehoe's and the first director of the CIA in 1947. Intent on pushing UFOs into the political arena, Kehoe and other NICAP members appeared on television and radio 900 times from 1957 to 1966. Because of close and reliable contacts within the military, Kehoe had been privy to much of the early, and secret, information concerning the Air Force's confusion over flying saucers. He knew that many sightings had been made by impeccable witnesses who had reported fantastic things and that lacking feasible alternatives, many intelligence analysts had leaned toward interplanetary as an explanation. Based on this information, Kehoe had written many of the early articles and books on the subject. In 1950, he had concluded that the Air Force knew the origin of these splendid and mysterious craft and that official statements, contradictory as they appear, were simply part of an intricate program to prepare America, and the world, for the secret of the discs. 7 years later, if the Air Force had a secret, they still were keeping it. As head of NICAP, Kehoe opened war on two fronts, one with the Air Force for keeping UFOs classified, and the other with the lunatic fringe for tainting the study of UFOs by legitimate investigators. Too many people constantly confused NICAP with the crazies who had flown to Venus and eaten space potatoes. Though he was convinced UFOs were of extraterrestrial origin, he refused membership to anyone who claimed contact with the occupants. One of many letters he wrote to contactees went to Howard Menger. "We have been informed," he said, "that during your lectures and upon other occasions, you have stated that this committee endorses your claims and views, including your claims to have met and talked with space people and to have visited the moon. This is to inform you that this committee does not in any way endorse such claims by you or anyone else." While battling to avoid the stigma of the contactees, Kehoe also fought the military on Capitol Hill by pushing for congressional hearings on UFOs. He wrote letters, made speeches, and provided current information to congressmen, impressing many with the quality and quantity of the facts he presented. But each time his lobbying efforts persuaded a House or Senate subcommittee to consider an open hearing on UFOs, the Air Force would somehow convince one or two of the members that the whole matter of UFOs perpetuated itself only because the public had an insatiable appetite for the fantastic. Congressional hearings, they said, would merely give dignity to the subject out of all proportion to which it is entitled. Whatever they were, said the Air Force, UFOs were harmless, at the most, perhaps, curious. The country was safe. Kehoe, however, felt he had abundant proof that something, indeed, was happening and that the Air Force not only had been inept in its efforts to solve the problem but had made contradictory, misleading, and untrue statements to congressmen and the public. So strongly did Kehoe believe the Air Force was concealing what his editor had called the biggest story since the birth of Christ that he proposed a showdown, before the House Subcommittee on Space Problems and Life Sciences, NICAP and the Air Force would present evidence on the existence of superior craft piloted, or otherwise controlled, by extraterrestrial beings. Then, NICAP would answer Air Force questions, and the Air Force would answer NICAP questions. If the subcommittee agreed with NICAP, Kehoe wanted an end to the secrecy. If Kehoe's proof failed to convince the subcommittee, he would dismantle the entire NICAP organization. But before the scheduled pre-hearing, one member of the subcommittee spoke with Blue Book personnel privately and concluded there was no need even to consider the hearings. The head of the subcommittee then attacked Kehoe for his malicious intent toward a great branch of the military. He called Kehoe's proposal a cheap scheme to discredit the Air Force. But the Air Force's own special advisor to Project Blue Book, Dr. Alan Hynek, had secretly and consistently suggested that the Air Force delve deeper into the UFO phenomenon. Although he could explain most of the 15,000 sightings that had come to his attention, he wrote in the Saturday Evening Post in 1966 that several hundred are puzzling, and some of the puzzling incidents, perhaps one in 25, are bewildering. As Kehoe waged his war in the halls of Congress during the late 50s and early 60s, the public cited fewer and fewer mysterious objects flying in the sky. Constituents lessened the pressure on congressmen for answers, and reports coming into Blue Book decreased so markedly that Hynek himself thought the phenomenon might go away. Then, one night in March 1966, 87 co-eds at Hillsdale College in Michigan watched a glow of red, yellow, and green lights rise from a swamp only a few hundred yards from their dormitory. Roughly football-shaped, the glow seemed suddenly to fly at the dormitory. Then, it stopped. Then, it flew back to the swamp where it hovered. The county civil defense director watched the glowing object through binoculars for 3 hours. The following night, 63 miles away, A dozen people in Dexter, Michigan, several of them police officers, watched another glowing object rise from a marshy area on a farm. At about 1,000 feet, the object stopped, hovered for a few minutes, and then flew away. A farmer and his son had approached to within 500 yards of the object and heard it take off with the sound of a ricocheting bullet. The two sightings sent reporters into a frenzy, and the Air Force dispatched Hynek to investigate.